This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. My guest today is Allison Macrina. She's a librarian, internet activist, and the founder and director of the Library Freedom Project. You can find her and the project at libraryfreedomproject.org. Circulating Ideas is brought to you with support from the University of South Carolina School of Library and Information Science and from listeners like you. Allison Macrina, welcome back to Circulating Ideas.
Happy to be back.
To start, give a brief overview of what the Library Freedom Project is all about, and then we can kind of get into the brief update of that, and then what you've been up to since then.
Yeah, Library Freedom Project is an initiative that I started after the Snowden revelations came out in 2013. And our goals are to teach librarians and their local communities about practical privacy strategies, kind of understanding the surveillance and privacy landscape, but all in the interest of bringing real, meaningful programs and services back into our libraries to protect kind of what we do in-house and to give our patrons the skills to protect themselves through public education.
Right. So, I mean, it fits right into the mission of libraries. I mean, we're educating our public, we're educating our staff, we're kind of doing the ethics of the librarianship and getting that out there. So,
yeah, and we have a strong commitment to privacy, too, or at least an ideological, theoretical commitment to it. I think that what I saw as part of the need was that something has happened in libraries in the last 15 or 20 years where as most of the services that are available to us, like databases and discovery platforms and things like that, are run by third parties rather than run by us or third party private companies, so not even nonprofits necessarily.
Right.
Because, you know, profit-driven business models on the internet are the same as data-driven business models because data is so valuable. What we've ended up with is many services that don't share our values. So there's the whole issue that the public needs to be educated on privacy, but then there's another one where we're not even following our own beliefs, in part because we haven't had much of a choice, or we haven't felt like we've had much of a choice.
Yeah, and sometimes there's layers upon layers of that, because you may say, well, I'm okay with what OverDrive specifically does, but then they're affiliated with Amazon, which then gives you another layer of information and data being passed back and forth that may not fit into with our values.
Yeah, exactly. Often we have our own privacy policies about how we'll keep patron info or share it or whatever, and it actually is not compatible with these vendors. And OverDrive is a great example because they even violate their own privacy policy with their relationship with Amazon, or at least they did for years. I haven't checked to see if they've like quietly removed their policy or something.
And this is kind of, I think, outside the scope of Library Freedom Project, unless it got huge or something. But do you think that's something that librarians need to be more trained on, of being able to build these things ourselves? Because that's why we kind of rely on these other companies, because it seems like there's nobody in the field that can or is willing to or is funded to actually create these. Like, besides a couple of things like Koha, Evergreen, things like that, there's not a lot of like ILSs that are homegrown, open source kind of things.
Yeah, it's a many layered problem. I mean, it would be like there's the tech side of it, where it would be great if we had the technical skills and labor and funding to pay for those platforms to be built. And you mentioned a couple, and those are awesome. But it doesn't even touch the rest of the landscape of what's out there and what we're forced to use. And then the other side of it, I think, is related to the abysmal state of access and open access to scholarly materials, and how much of a racket that is for, you know, publicly funded, publicly researched information that is then sold through publishers and then sold again to a private platform. And, you know, there are all these big, enormous social problems that we need to solve, and we're barely able to like get the work done that we need to do in our own library. So I get it. And I don't expect librarians to be able to solve all these issues. I think, you know, one thing that I've tried to focus on with Library Freedom Project is actionable things that can be done right now. And so even just understanding what kind of vendor agreements, what's contained in those, and what the best practices are for privacy, and what kind of demands we need to be making, and recognizing that we do have power to tell our vendors what we want to see and what we don't want to see. And I think that we quite often as librarians get stuck in this thinking that we just have to take whatever is offered to us, and you know, we never get anything nice, and that's just how it is. And I think we should dispatch that idea, because we've ended up with a lot of crappy stuff that way.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's how we got into this mess, because I think, I mean, why wouldn't these for-profit companies take everything that they can get if we're going to give it to them? And, I mean, if we say no, then they can't, and they might work with us and compromise. But if we're just going to roll over, then why wouldn't they just take advantage of that?
Right, totally.
So the last time you were on, I actually went back and listened, and it was, we talked, I think, like a day or two before the Kilton Library Board met to decide to bring their Tor node back online. So we kind of left it as a cliffhanger kind of thing.
This is a 2-year cliffhanger. Yes.
So I did include a link in the old show notes of saying that it'd come back online and everything. But can you give a brief, I don't want to go over it too much in too much detail because we talked about it last time, but give a brief overview of kind of that situation and how you guys were involved with that.
Yeah. So Library Freedom Project, in the summer of 2015, we set up a Tor node at a library in Lebanon, New Hampshire, the Lebanon Public Libraries. A Tor node is, for anyone unfamiliar, the Tor network is a network that provides anonymity and privacy on the internet. Most people who use Tor use it through something called Tor Browser, which is a web browser that's basically patched to fix the different kind of privacy holes that web browsers typically have. And then everything is routed over the Tor network, which gives you some privacy as to your location and the websites you visit and other fun stuff like that. So the way that the network is powered is by these nodes all over the world that are run by volunteers that essentially just push the traffic back and forth. And we at Library Freedom Project decided that we wanted to try to start pushing libraries to run these nodes because it really fits in with our values and it's a good service. It helps everybody everywhere and all these lovely things. And so our friend Chuck from the Lebanon libraries, we'd already worked with him a few times. We'd done some different trainings. He was really a big Tor fan and was really just the right person and right location to have this happen first. So we set this node up, and then almost immediately the Department of Homeland Security like contacted the local police and tried to get the node shut down. And then there was this big hullabaloo. Basically, the conclusion was that the community in Lebanon, New Hampshire, and surrounding towns, but many people locally, the community was super supportive of the library, wanted to keep the node online. We got a lot of nationwide support. The Electronic Frontier Foundation ran a petition for us. We got like 5,000 signatures in just a couple days. We got some pretty big national press coverage. So it was just this really overwhelming positive on our side, support and response to what a lot of people, I think, rightly saw as totally unnecessary government meddling. DHS is a federal agency. They had no right to tell a municipal library what kind of business they should do. It was a total like preemptive strike, to borrow from some Iraq warriors language, that nothing had even happened, right? There was no like criminal activity or anything like that that like came through the node. It was, the node had been online very briefly, and so the DHS wanted to shut it down before anything even happened. And so so today it is still online. That library has gone on to do some really amazing privacy related things. They have regular classes for the public. They've got their whole environment on Linux. There are so many other awesome things that Chuck is doing over there. And, you know, we're just so glad that he and Lebanon Libraries were our first node.
Yeah, and I think that's a pretty good indication that Tor does work, that they were wanting to be that
Yeah, totally,
preemptive about it.
totally.
Because it's not, I mean, because sometimes they'll wait for an act, like they waited for the San Bernardino thing to try to break into iPhones and things like that. So, I mean, they'll wait for an incident to happen before they'll try to make a big grab, like power grab like that. But yeah, just the fact that it turned on and there was no incident that they could even say, oh, well, terrorists bought guns through that library or whatever they would come up with. But just, it's on.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, no, that's a good point.
And you had mentioned before that there's even some conflict at the federal level because you, I think, what is it, the State Department still, I don't know if they still do, but they did at the time, recommended Tor to, especially overseas, for people to be able to communicate
This
privately.
the State Department provides a significant amount of TOR's funding. It's a real like it can boggle the mind, and it can make people really suspicious about TOR if you don't understand a little bit more of where scientific and technical funding comes from. I mean, the fact is that we live in a country that runs the largest military in the world by a long shot, and we put most of our public money into defense. I see this as a very bad thing. And one of the consequences of it is that all research, and this is like university research, not even just scientific and technical, but like anthropological research and things like that, are funded by the Department of Defense, the State Department. And, you know, this is, I don't think this is a good thing for democracy. I think that like most of the my personal feeling is that those agencies should be completely defunded. But the fact is that, you know, Tor is just getting money where money is available. That's basically what it is. But Tor, you know, is really trying to diversify funding now, because, you know, what if something were to happen where suddenly the State Department is like, wait, we don't want to fund these people. And then there's also the just interesting kind of quandary where it's like one part of the State Department is funding Tor, and then like other parts of it are actively trying to sabotage it. And you know, the NSA hates Tor and the FBI hates Tor, but then like sometimes they want to use it, and the Navy also uses it, and the Navy was very instrumental in its early research and still participates in Tor related research because they have an interest in protecting their communication. I mean, it's just a big it's a big world.
It's and it's like, well, it was supported well, maybe under a different administration, but maybe a current
Right.
administration that will not be named may not be as friendly to this sort of thing and
Yeah.
actively
Well,
hostile toward it even. So.
yeah, you know, interestingly, there's a story behind where the original kind of like internet freedom, quote unquote, funding started coming from the State Department. And I don't know the whole story, but my understanding is that it actually wasn't, it was not like an Obama era initiative. It was before that, and that it was in fact like Republican lawmakers, maybe some Republican senators who were responding to petitioning from some of their constituents who were like Christian missionary types who went to China and met with some people in the minority religious group Falun Gong. And the Falun Gong folks were like, yeah, we're being censored by the Chinese government. And these very conservative Christian missionaries were like, that's despicable and terrible and it's undemocratic and we have to go home and get some money to pay, like to fund the kinds of tools that you use to get around censorship. And so they went home and they did that. And so it was actually Republican lawmakers that did this. So it's very interesting. And the other thing is that you know, even if the Obama administration had continued this kind of funding, I mean, as we know, it's the Obama administration that oversaw the expansion of all of the NSA's mass surveillance. And so it's not like they had much of an interest in like making it this nice thing. But that but you bring up a good point because something that I used to say during a somewhat simpler time, I don't want to make it sound like things were okay in the world a year ago. They
Way
certainly were not,
back yonder.
right? But at least we had like maybe good days and bad days, or less bad days. What one thing I used to say is, you know, to a lot of my audiences, librarians tend to fall on a certain point of the political spectrum. And I would say, look, you know, you might feel like you're under a you know, presidential administration, political administration that you trust to have this information. I don't agree, but let's say you feel that way. Maybe you think that like Obama has the right idea about this and this is fine. What you need to understand is that he's built an infrastructure that will persist after he's gone. And what I used to say then was, you know, imagine if we get a Trump presidency and then Trump has access to all this and everybody would be like, oh my God. And I said it as like, what's the worst possible timeline? And here's just to make a point, and then wow, here we are.
Yep. Yeah. So since all of the stuff that happened with the Tor node in New Hampshire, have you seen a growth in Tor adoption by other libraries? Have they been emboldened by that at all?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, so while we've set up fewer nodes than I would have liked, I think that that is still something that people are. It's not that I think that the New Hampshire story really caught a lot of people's interest and made a lot more libraries really want to support Tor. But what I hadn't really anticipated at the time was that Chuck was just extraordinarily prepared to set something like that up. It's not actually that like technically difficult. I think more people can set one up than they kind of think that they can. But what I found was that there was a lot of hesitation about setting up the nodes because people didn't think they had the technical acumen. And also because they were like, oh, this is so great, but like, will you come and teach us what Tor is first? Like, we're maybe not really ready for that next step. So it certainly, it did boost people's interest in Tor. You know, we went on, Library Freedom Project did like many, many trainings, I think, that came directly from that. A lot of libraries have installed Tor Browser, which is also a really great initiative. I mean, not every library needs to run a Tor node. You know, having Tor Browser available for your patrons to use is really huge. So yeah, there was a really massive, I think, just interest in the library world about Tor. And something cool that I started noticing after that was that Tor started to come up like on the conference circuit in library stuff, and it wasn't from me, you know. So before Library Freedom Project, I think the only other person I'd heard talk about Tor was Jason Griffey, and it was only a couple of times. And now I feel like it's something that people, even if they don't fully understand what it is, they've heard about it in a library context. And so, you know, I think that's been a really amazing development.
That's great. So I saw back, I looked back on your Twitter feed while I was looking over to plan this interview, and I saw that you had done a survey back in the spring. Have you compiled what that survey got to you, and did you get some good information from that?
Yeah, I was mostly just trying to get a sense of how, you know, it was a very informal survey. I was just trying to get a sense of like, you know, of some non-representative sample, you know, what were libraries doing. And I was really pleasantly surprised to see that something like a fourth of the people who filled out the survey were running Tor Browser in their libraries. Now, of course, you know, like I said, it's a non-representative sample. It's like a lot of people who have already worked with and stuff. But, you know, even just getting some feedback about what would be more helpful, you know, the main thing that I heard from that was that people always want more training around this stuff. And, you know, that's primarily what I do at Library Freedom Project, is go around and teach librarians about privacy and teach them the tools and teach them how to use Tor and how to install it and all that stuff. But it was, you know, to get back to your main point about what Library Freedom Project has been up to the last couple of years, you know, we've been doing these trainings and kind of trying to think about how to meet the demand at a scale. And that's really hard because we're such a tiny organization. Like, I say the word we all the time, but it's mainly me. I mean, there are other people who work with Library Freedom Project. I mean, we still do a lot with the ACLU, and we have, you know, a few people who I work with here and there. But it's certainly not we don't have the capacity to go to libraries across the country regularly and be teaching these. So I'm very excited about the next thing that we'll be doing. I just got some funding from, well, I will get it, I want it, some funding from IMLS to start an intensive training program for librarians. So we'll do two rounds of it, and it will train a total of 40 people, and it'll be a 6-month long training program. So with IMLS funding, it's going to be totally free, which is amazing. It's all online, except there's one in-person component, and we'll pay for travel and all that sort of stuff. And basically the goal is to create some regional expertise in libraries. So trying to target different points all over the country to make people who know how to do essentially what I've been doing. So with 40 people, I think we can cover a lot of ground.
So you're seeing it kind of as like a train the trainer kind of thing. So these people can then go out and kind of be trainers themselves and keep the circle growing.
Yeah, exactly. And we'll, as part of the class, we'll do like curriculum development. There's going to be a lot of things that are focused on learning the skills, but then there are some other things about like, you know, public speaking and facilitating training and that sort of thing that we'll cover. I'm going to have some really awesome guest lecturers from different organizations that LFP has worked with over the years. So definitely ACLU people, definitely, you know, I haven't gotten confirmation from them yet, but I'm sure that I will get people from like EFF and other cool organizations like Witness, which works on citizens filming the police. A smorgasbord of cool activists and lawyers and other librarians maybe. And like I said, it's free. So I hope that, you know, I hope people will want to do it. I think they will. I think it's a pretty cool idea.
No, it's very awesome. And you're doing it kind of in partnership with New York University. Is that sort of just a place you're doing it? Or are you working with them somehow?
Yeah. So we're working together. The IMLS, you know, New York University is providing the kind of like institutional, legitimacy that IMLS needs.
Right.
And also, they are very skilled at offering online classes. I mean, I've never done anything of this, you know, size mm-hmm. on my own. And so they're going to do a lot of the kind of infrastructural things and helping prepare the curriculum and doing evaluations and all that fun stuff. And then, of course, we'll use their facilities, the in-person, requirement of the program, which by the way is called Library Freedom Institute. I forgot to mention that. The in-person component will be in New York City, so we'll probably use some NYU facilities.
That's great. do you have any idea when it'll be kicking off? I know you said the 6-month thing, but when do you think it'll be
happening? Aiming for the first. The like I said, there's going to be two rounds, and the pilot round, aiming for around like June of 2018. I'm getting started right now in kind of like early recruitment stuff. You know, there'll be an application for interested participants to fill out. But you know, right now, if there are people who are interested in learning more about the program, you know, it's really the very, very early stages because we just got notification from IMLS. Like, I haven't even put anything on the Library Freedom Project website yet. But if there are some really eager people who want to learn more about it, they can get in touch with me at allison@libraryfreedomproject.org.
Well, it sounds awesome, and I look forward to it. And I'll help push out the information for it when it comes, and maybe after it's all wrapped up, you can come back on again and talk about the project and how it all went through. So
yeah, definitely, I'd love to.
And the one last thing I wanted to ask you about was just back to sort of the origins of Library Freedom Project. Do you think that come about from, you said from the after the Snowden revelations, did you kind of look at how the library world reacted to it and it was lacking, and you thought we needed to have a better reaction to that sort of thing?
So I'm glad you asked that, because I often forget about what kind of motivated me in the beginning there. So the Snowden stuff happened, and I was somewhat active with Boston's Radical Reference chapter, and I wrote to them, and I wrote to the broader Radical Reference list, and I was like, hey, you know, I'd really like to get something going among some other kind of anti-surveillance minded librarians. Does anybody want to work on a project? And honestly, in my head, I was like, maybe we'll just go over to like a big highway and drop a banner that says like librarians against the NSA. Like, I really wasn't thinking necessarily long term. I was just like, I was so angry and I wanted to do something. And I was thinking a lot about our, you know, we responded as a profession, I think, really strongly against the Patriot Act. I mean, that's a thing that many librarians, at least the ones that are a little bit around my age, credit with why they joined the profession. And it's this really great part of our history. And so I was like, oh, okay, well, here's something that is at least as important, if not probably much more important than that, just given the scale of it. And maybe we can have some kind of response like that. So I collected this little group of librarians, and we started kind of brainstorming what we wanted to do. And out of that came a couple of things. One, a few of us got together and started asking around other, one of our initial ideas was we wanted to put together a kind of like compendium of what librarians are doing to work on practical privacy. And then we would make that into a kind of like info packet and then distribute that like, oh, these other librarians are doing this thing. They're teaching these classes. They're doing these like, you know, public lectures or whatever. You can be like them, and here's what they're doing. So we started asking around and found out that people really were interested, but they just didn't know what to do. And so it was very different from, for example, the Patriot Act opposition, because that was like, it was very clear. It was like, we just say no to this. We don't know what's about to happen, but we know that whatever is about to happen is all bad. The mass surveillance stuff is different because it's not simply that we need a political solution for it. We need these technical solutions too, or at least in the immediate sense, we need the technical solutions because we have to protect ourselves. And nobody really knew what was good, and there's a lot of misinformation. And so that small group of librarians and I made a zine, and we I ended up finishing the zine. It was like practical privacy tips. I like stapled it in my friend Jamie's apartment, and like then went to, like, drove from Boston to New York, like stapled it in the middle of the night, and then went to the Radical Archives conference and the Urban Librarians Unite conference and like distributed this zine, and people were real into it. But it was really like this like ad hoc thing, trying to get something together and get people talking about stuff. You know, I very, very quickly after that was like, okay, once again, there's a strong need for this. There are many people, many librarians, I think, who want this information. I can't print a zine for all of them. And so maybe I need to do something else. And that's when I started teaching the classes. So just to get back to your earlier question, yes, I saw that there was something lacking in libraries, but I don't want to make it sound like people were, you know, there was a real acknowledgement that this was, that there was an absence, but it was like suddenly this very serious thing had hit us all and no one really knew what they could do.
Right.
And so, you know, Library Freedom Project has always been a kind of train the trainer operation. It's just that the trainings were so much shorter for so long, and even just getting people a little bit of information, you know, to help their patrons make better passwords and things like that. Like that, I think that has, I hope it's helped a lot of people. And so now, I want to make it into a real kind of like institutional reality. You know, I want like many initiatives across the country, many little library freedom projects, or like one big one where we're all kind of meeting a different need. And because I think that regional needs are a lot different. You know, I think about like, what is it like for libraries that are along the border? What's it like for libraries that are in, for example, like the Dearborn, Michigan area, which is a very Muslim area that has seen some of the worst police, federal and local police surveillance. These are things that can really best needs that are really best served by people who live in those communities and know those community members, really well themselves.
And that's just in the US, so.
Yeah, right.
So if people want to learn more about the Library Freedom Project, where should they go to find out more?
They can go to libraryfreedomproject.org. And like I said before, if people want to reach out to me directly about the new Library Freedom Institute or just any of the other work that we're doing, teaching workshops and doing other kinds of trainings for librarians, they can write to me at Allison with one L, Alison, at libraryfreedomproject.org.
And Allison's not going to say this, but you can go to their site and donate to them too to help out if you like what they're doing. So.
Yeah, do it.
All right, thanks a lot, Allison, for the update on everything you guys are doing, and hope to talk to you again after on the show again after your institute's gone.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Thanks. Bye. Circulating Ideas is produced by Steve Thomas in the suburbs of Atlanta, with support from the University of South Carolina School of Library and Information Science and from listeners like you. Find out how you can help support the show by going to circulatingideas.com and clicking on support. Help others find the show by subscribing, rating, and reviewing the show at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Overcast, or your podcast app of choice. Follow the show on Twitter at @CircIdeas or the show's Facebook page. Our music is by Pamela Klicka. Thank you for listening, and keep circulating your ideas.